Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us. My name is Jenny Pagel-Guile, and I am the Executive Director of the National Pancreas Foundation. We would like to welcome you to Navigating Exocrine and Endocrine Challenges Post-Acute Pancreatitis. First, I'd like to kick off with a little bit of information about the National Pancreas Foundation and how you can learn more. Our impact spans across the country. We've awarded over $5 million in grants. We have 190-plus centers of excellence. And we have programs, chapters, and volunteer opportunities across the country. On our website, you can find more resources if you're looking to become a center of excellence or if you are looking for different care within your treatment area. We have a full list of centers of excellence as well as webinars on our website. Also, if you have patients or if you are a patient yourself or a care provider, we are always looking for volunteer opportunities. We offer tabling to spread awareness within the community. You're able to partner with centers of excellence. We have national advocacy days and various fundraising opportunities. You can reach out to Cheyenne on the NPF staff to learn more information, or any NPF staff member would be happy to direct you. Right now, if you haven't been familiar, our Camp Hope initiative, the application is open. This will be our fifth year partnering with Rebecca's Wish. It's a one-of-a-kind pancreatitis camp for kids with pancreatitis post-TPIAT. One of our speakers today is very involved in Camp Hope as well, but we are looking for campers, volunteers, and medical professionals to participate in the event. So find more information online, complete the application, or SOCPAL would be happy to answer any additional questions as well. This is a great opportunity to see patients in a different spotlight. A few other resources that we just want to make you aware of. One of our most popular videos and online resources is the animated pancreas patient. So if you have somebody that is newly diagnosed, somebody that wants to learn more about the pancreas, either for your staff or somebody that's new, feel free to check out these resources. They are available on demand on our website, and there's a variety of opportunities again for you to view these. Also, it's the holiday season, so there are lots of temptations on the table. We do have several options and resources available around nutrition that feed into our diabetes topic today. But we have two cookbooks available for purchase, and there are a few sample recipes on our website as well. Our centers of excellence have all been shared several of these copies, but they are available for order if you need more or if you know someone in your life that is looking for a more pancreas-friendly diet. Also, if you are a center of excellence and you're looking to be more involved, there is an opportunity for you to start your own fundraiser. Many chapters and centers of excellence participate in our bowling event, but if you have something in mind like a community walk, a pickleball, a bake sale, please reach out to us or there's an opportunity to create that with on your own online. We also have a medical professional portal. This is just one of the topics. Today's an example of what you can find online. We have over 25 webinars currently posted. These are all on demand. This is in sponsorship with AbbVie, our great partner. So feel free to check these out. Many of them are CME opportunities that are free. You don't have to be a Center of Excellence member. It can be anyone in the community or medical field. These are, again, all available on demand, presented by your peers in the field, and we try and keep them as up to date as possible. To learn more about programs like these and keep up to date on what's going on with the National Pancreas Foundation, we have a monthly newsletter you can sign up for, and there are several social media platforms that you can reach us on. And now, without further ado, I would like to introduce our speakers today. Again, this is sponsored by AbbVie, Navigating Exocrine and Endocrine Challenges Post-Acute Pancreatitis. First is Dr. Bellin. She is on the National Pancreas Foundation Board of Directors, but she is a tenured professor of pediatrics, endocrinology, and surgery at the University of Minnesota, where her research centers on pancreatitis and cell-based therapies for type 1 and surgical diabetes. She is a leading innovator in total pancreatectomy with isolate transplantation, having led multiple randomized clinical trials, defined long-term TPIAT outcomes, advanced in use in children with hereditary pancreatitis, and served as the site PI or co-chair for major national consortia. With approximately 200 peer-reviewed publications, she has also led numerous NIH-funded grants and contributed extensively to clinical trials involving transplantation and stem cell-derived isolate products. Our other speaker is tenured professor of medicine at the University of Pittsburgh and serves as the vice chair for clinical research in the Department of Medicine, as well as the Associate Chief of Clinical Research and Academic Development in the Division of Gastroenterology, Hepatology, and Nutrition at UPMC. A medical pancreatologist, his clinical and research work focuses on pancreatic disease with NIH and Department of Defense-funded studies and leadership roles in major consortia such as T1-DPAC and CPCRC. He has authored more than 250 peer-reviewed publications, is an active educator who co-directs the Emerge Mentoring Program, and frequently speaks at national and international conferences. Thank you so much to our speakers for joining us, and I will turn it over to Dr. Bellin to help moderate and set the platform for today's talk.
All right, thank you, Jenny. On behalf of myself and Dr. Yadav, thank you to the National Pancreas Foundation for the opportunity to join and participate in this webinar series, and thank you to AbbVie for funding this session. The topic today will be focused on acute pancreatitis, and particularly the complications of digestive pancreas issues, exocrine pancreatic insufficiency, and diabetes that may occur after acute pancreatitis. We spend quite a bit of time thinking about this with chronic pancreatitis in the clinic, and it's been more recently recognized that this is a real issue that needs recognition and in acute pancreatitis. So that'll be our focus today. Our learning objective is that participants will understand the long-term complications that can arise after an acute pancreatitis episode, including exocrine pancreas insufficiency and diabetes. This webinar is structured a little differently than some other webinars. We don't have PowerPoint slides. We're not giving you a presentation. We're actually going to have a conversation and a dialogue between Dr. Yadav and myself on this topic. And we'll start with the exocrine pancreas insufficiency and then move after that to the diabetes. And we'll have some time for questions and answer at the end. We'll try to be really concise because it's a pretty brief session. So with that, we'll begin the conversation, and I'm going to start by asking Dr. Yadav some questions about the exocrine function of the pancreas in acute pancreatitis. But I wanted to start with an overview of acute pancreatitis. So, Dheeraj, can you please explain to us what is acute pancreatitis? Why does it happen? What causes it? And what are we talking about when we talk about mild and severe acute pancreatitis?
Thank you, Melina, and good afternoon, everyone. So acute pancreatitis is an acute inflammatory condition of the pancreas. It typically presents with patients having sudden onset of abdominal pain, which is usually in the upper part of the abdomen, although in some patients it can involve other areas of the abdomen also. The pain is usually severe, and in subsets of patients, it can actually even radiate to the back. Some patients can also have nausea and vomiting as part of their symptoms. The pain is usually significant enough, and most patients with acute pancreatitis end up going to the hospital to help in management. Now, there are many different causes of acute pancreatitis. The most common is gallstones. So stones from the gallbladder can pass through the bile duct and can transiently obstruct the opening into the intestine. Heavy alcohol consumption can cause pancreatitis. And other uncommon but important causes would include medications, high triglyceride levels, and then some other uncommon or less common causes. The large majority of patients who have acute pancreatitis, roughly 80 to 85%, have something called mild acute pancreatitis. What that means is typically patients improve between 3 to 5 days of hospital admission with initial IV fluid management, and then they can start their diet. That is usually a low-fat diet initially, and that can be advanced over the next few days. But a subset of patients can have more severe disease where they have significant damage to the pancreas that may need longer stay in the hospital, and there may be additional complications.
Yeah, thank you. And then we're going to talk a little specifically about a disorder called exocrine pancreas insufficiency, or sometimes people call that exocrine pancreas dysfunction as well. You might hear those terms used interchangeably. Can you tell us, I mean, I guess first of all, what that is, and then what are the symptoms, and why might that happen after an episode of acute pancreatitis?
Yes, exocrine pancreatic insufficiency is a condition where the pancreas, which typically has two functions, one of the important functions of the pancreas is to make digestive enzymes that are secreted and flushed from the pancreas into the intestine, usually after we eat food. And if the reason for that is pancreas enzymes helps to break the food down so that the body can absorb it. Now, when pancreas is not functioning very well, what it can do is that the food is not digested, and that could result in symptoms. The most classic symptom of EPI is when patients may describe having fatty or oily stools, but patients can also describe having just multiple bowel movements a day. But some patients who do not have severe exocrine insufficiency can also have other symptoms which are not as specific. So, in other words, they can just have abdominal bloating, distension, and just not feeling well. And that's something that, in the right context, is good to pick up because then you can evaluate that further and even help patients.
And so, how often does this happen, exocrine pancreatic insufficiency, after acute pancreatitis specifically? And can you talk about what the risk factors might be, that would lead someone to develop this?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, Dr. Bellin, we typically associate exocrine insufficiency with chronic pancreatitis because there is fibrosis and scarring of the pancreas. But we are starting to learn that patients with acute pancreatitis can also have EPI. Now, typically, this happens in patients who have significant destruction of the pancreas by something called pancreas necrosis. Because as you can imagine, if there is physical destruction of the pancreas, it's not able to do digestive function. In patients who have moderate or severe disease, that means they have necrosis or they have organ failure, in those patients, the risk is noted to be somewhere around 30 to 40%. But more importantly, we are recognizing that patients who have mild acute pancreatitis, that means these are patients who recover within a few days of their illness and their pancreas returns to normal. Even in those patients, about one in five patients, if you follow them over time, they may show signs of EPI and may be helped by appropriate treatment. Now, you also asked with regard to what causes exocrine insufficiency. Now, in patients who have moderate or severe disease, as you would imagine, there is physical destruction of the pancreas, so it's not able to do its job. But then in patients with mild acute pancreatitis, we are not very sure with regard to what are the mechanisms. And some of the ongoing studies are hopefully going to be helpful in improving our understanding about that.
Excellent. So you see a patient with acute pancreatitis in your clinic all the time as a gastroenterologist. You have a patient who walks in with acute pancreatitis, and say it's one of those mild episodes, right, where everything sort of seems to return to normal in terms of the appearance of the pancreas. What do you recommend for your patients? Do you monitor them for exocrine insufficiency? And can you talk about how long and maybe actually even how you would monitor them for that?
Yeah, that's a good question and a very important question because until recently, when patients had mild acute pancreatitis, we didn't really follow these patients and we did not even recommend for follow-up of these patients in terms of how the pancreas is functioning. Now, the guidelines in terms of exocrine or EPI assessment are still unclear in terms of what is the best time to assess. But typically, in patients who have moderate or severe disease that they have pancreas necrosis, often we start the treatment depending upon how much necrosis is there. If it is 30% or more, we actually start them on enzymes while they are in the hospital or at the time of discharge. And then when they come back for follow-up, then to reassess how they are doing and then tailor treatment. In patients who have mild disease, it has been suggested that they should get a fecal elastase, which is an easily available stool test that could be performed to assess their function several weeks after their pancreatitis has improved. That is typically 3 to 6 months after the episode of pancreatitis. We should also be looking at their symptoms or talking to them about symptoms because sometimes symptoms can give us an idea that they may have underlying EPI and they may need to be further evaluated.
Yeah, excellent. And maybe I'll ask you a little bit more about this approach to diagnosing EPI. Maybe in particular the fecal elastase, right? If you have someone who has nonspecific symptoms and they're in front of you. I know I hear from the gastroenterologist that the fecal elastase can be a little bit tricky. There can be reasons why it's falsely low. Maybe talk about that diagnostic process a little bit.
Yeah, and I think it is important to understand what exactly this test is and what it is doing. So typically, as I mentioned, pancreas makes digestive enzymes to help to digest food. Now, fecal elastase is a representative of another type of enzyme. What it does is that typically enzymes are proteins, and these proteins are digested or broken down during their transit from the into the through the GI tract. So in the stool, we are not able to pick up enzymes. Now, fecal elastase is an enzyme that does not get altered as much during passage through the GI tract. So that allows us to measure it in the stool, and that could give us a rough idea with regard to the function of the pancreas. Now, one of the things that we have noted over time, and there has been a lot of literature, is that there are many patients who may have an abnormal fecal elastase, but that does not necessarily mean that they have pancreas insufficiency. There are many conditions that could lead to what is called as non-specific reduction in fecal elastase. A most common example is that if you have diarrhea for any reason, that could lead to diluted stools, and that would lead to a low fecal elastase level. And then there are some other causes of importance that the physicians think about when there is a low fecal elastase level. Now, it is important for the physicians to recognize this so that they can put the results of fecal elastase into context of patient symptoms and then appropriately determine as to the best course of treatment.
Yeah. Well, great. That leads us right to treatment. And I know you started to reference this a little bit earlier about putting patients on pancreatic enzymes after severe acute pancreatitis. Can you walk us through treatment and pancreatic enzymes? And are those only prescription, or what about these over-the-counter things that people talk about? What is your treatment approach?
Yeah, so when I decide that I have to give pancreas enzymes to patients, I think that one of the most important things as a physician is to make sure that if you decide to give pancreas enzyme, you give the right doses. Because we very commonly see that A, patients are not evaluated, and if they are evaluated and treated, the treatment, they're usually undertreated for the amount of enzymes they need. So as an example, typically, pancreas enzymes are dosed by what is called as lipase in the enzyme. So about 1,000 units of lipase per meal is the standard recommendation, which translates to about 50,000 to 70,000 lipase units per meal, and roughly half of that with the snack. The way I recommend patients to take lipase is, or the pancreas enzyme capsules is, to split the capsule depending on the timing of the meal. So as an example, I ask them to take one pill as soon as they are starting to eat, one in the middle of the meal, and one before they end. The reason is that would allow the enzymes to mix with food by the time they reach the intestine, and it can be digested. A subset of patients, even if you give them proper amount of pancreas enzymes, they may not respond as well. In that situation, you have to reevaluate the indication of treatment. But if they truly have EPI, then there are other things that you can do to help to increase the efficiency or action of pancreas enzymes. And the way that we do that, we give a medication to suppress the acid in the stomach so that you can reduce the inactivation of lipase in the stomach. That could allow the action of lipase to be more or prolonged. And then, in a subset of patients, when you have tried that and it is not working, bacterial overgrowth in the small intestine can sometimes lead to decreased activity. And in select patients, we treat them with antibiotics for a course of antibiotics and see if there is an improvement or not. But the key points here are is the right dosing. Number two, proper way to take the enzymes, and then to monitor symptoms.
Yeah, I think that's incredibly helpful. I also know that when I see patients post pancreatectomy, sometimes there's just barriers to, taking enzymes. It can be kind of challenging to remember to take these with every meal. They can be expensive. Can you just comment briefly on barriers that you've seen, if you have any approaches to address those?
Yeah, one of the most important barriers is that the enzymes are very expensive, and many of my patients, even if they have insurance, their copay with the enzymes can be really, really a lot, which actually is a significant barrier to taking enzymes. We try to help patients. We direct them to many of the companies have assistance programs for patients to be able to qualify, and if they qualify, they are able to get pancreatic enzymes from the companies through the programs, which can be very helpful. You also asked about over-the-counter pancreatic enzyme preparations. They are usually not as helpful because the primary reason is the amount of lipase units that's there in the over-the-counter medications is fairly small. So one may have to take lots and lots of pills to account for what they actually need. So often it is not very helpful, to use them. Okay, but Dr. Bellin, I know we are running out of time. I want to make sure that I ask you questions about diabetes, which is something very important. So my first question to you is, how often do you see diabetes in patients after acute pancreatitis? And is this diabetes similar to the routine diabetes that we see in general population, or is it different?
Yeah, those are excellent questions. I think, as you know, this is an area of ongoing research. You and I collaborate on a multi-center study called DREAM that is still collecting this data. But based on what we see in the literature, we think that probably about 15%, so say roughly one out of every eight patients who has acute pancreatitis is going to have diabetes by a couple of years after that episode. And that this may slowly actually increase over time, so there may be an ongoing risk yet even after those first couple of years. It can be really challenging in the clinic, to be honest. You know, sometimes these patients will get labeled as type 1 diabetes or type 2 diabetes, but we think it's really its own distinct subtype of diabetes that may overlap and share features with these over other forms of diabetes. But that we think that that injury that occurs to the pancreas during even mild acute pancreatitis, but certainly with more severe forms of acute pancreatitis, is really important in causing this form of diabetes. So we do consider it, sometimes people call it type 3C diabetes. Sometimes people call it post-pancreatitis diabetes. So we lack some common terminology, but you'll hear these various terms used for this.
And yes, it's important, as you mentioned, to recognize that diabetes occurs after pancreatitis, acute pancreatitis. Again, even in patients with mild acute pancreatitis, as you mentioned. But what are the challenges in making a diagnosis of diabetes after acute pancreatitis during the hospital and after discharge?
Well, so I think one of the biggest challenges that arise is just simply getting monitored, right? So unlike you're talking about exocrine insufficiency, and a lot of times there's symptoms with that. Oftentimes when people get diabetes, it's clinically kind of silent for a time. So they don't have a whole lot of symptoms. So one of the key challenges in diagnosing it is just monitoring. So we're typically to make this diagnosis looking at fasting blood glucose and hemoglobin A1c, the 3-month marker of average blood sugar. And it has the same diagnostic criteria as other forms of diabetes, an A1c of 6.5% and a fasting glucose of 126 or higher. But you have to actually monitor to detect it. And then sometimes we don't know if someone, kind of came in with acute pancreatitis, they've been pretty healthy. Maybe they haven't seen a physician in 3 years. They're not having annual lab work, right? Sometimes we just really don't know. Is this something that was already there before? Or is this new diabetes after the acute pancreatitis? So sometimes it's a little bit challenging to separate diabetes from acute pancreatitis from something that was, a pre-existing type 2 diabetes. So we don't always have a perfect answer.
So it obviously is very important for both physicians and also the patients to be aware about the risk of diabetes. Are there any guidelines in terms of, which patients should get diabetes testing after acute pancreatitis? When should they get it, and how often should they get it during the follow-up?
Yeah, so this is really a very recent kind of emerging field in terms of clinical guidelines. And the current consensus would be that, monitoring about 3 months, 3 to 6 months after an acute pancreatitis episode, and then once a year after that, is probably the routine recommendation for everyone. We have a, there's certainly research going on as to can we flag or identify a group of patients who's at higher risk who maybe needs more frequent monitoring, right? I think we don't have all the data for that yet. So these guidelines may change over time, but I think if you have someone who's had acute pancreatitis, it's pretty easy to do a fasting glucose and A1C. So a wise move to get them in, just for some lab work 3 months after they have that event, and then a year later, and just do yearly diabetes screening so that we can, detect diabetes and treat it early, before it becomes severe enough to present with clinical symptoms.
All right, that's actually very helpful information. So I know taking care of patients with acute pancreatitis in the hospital, most patients with acute pancreatitis, or many of them, they are treated by primary care physicians. Sometimes GI physicians are involved to for evaluation and management, but often endocrinologists may not see patients in the hospital. So my question to you is, which patients with acute pancreatitis should be referred to an endocrinologist? Should everybody be seen by endocrinology during hospital admission, or there are subsets of patients that would benefit from care in the hospital and as outpatients?
So I think there's two important topics there. One, what to do in the hospital, and one, what to do in the outpatient setting. And so it is, fairly common, even outside of diabetes that persists, to get some hyperglycemia during, a hospital admission for acute pancreatitis because the pancreas is inflamed, the islet cells, so that part of the pancreas that makes the insulin may not be working as well during that acute inflammatory event. I do think that if you have a patient in hospital who has significant hyperglycemia to the point where they need treatment, which in the hospital is usually going to be insulin treatment, that you should involve have an endocrinologist that's involved in that patient's admission. But if you have someone who, maybe has some blood glucoses of 150s, 160s, doesn't require treatment, or they don't have any hyperglycemia, you probably don't need an endocrinologist to see them at that time. In the outpatient setting, I think the screening can be done by primary care providers. I do think if someone gets diagnosed with actually having diabetes and acute pancreatitis, that it's wise to have them see an endocrinologist. I know that's not the routine for everyone who has, say, routine type 2 diabetes, but I do think that these patients have some additional complexities because they can have exocrine insufficiency, because they, have this other medical history, that having a specialty care team is actually really beneficial in that setting.
How do you decide with regard to the treatment, oral medications, which patients need insulin? And these days, as you know, the GLP medications actually are commonly used. And do you use these in patients with pancreatitis?
That's right. So the GLP-1 is actually a really tricky question. So maybe I'll start with sort of the other treatments first. Again, this is an area where we're lacking clinical trials. So none of this is guided by specific clinical trials in treatment of people with diabetes after acute pancreatitis. However, we know that some of these patients will have insulin deficiency from beta cell injury. And so I do think that people with significant hyperglycemia, especially if they're thin, they don't have characteristics of insulin resistance, may be best treated with insulin therapy. We know the population data reflects that, right? So if we look at population studies, for example, coming out of the United Kingdom, we see that people who have this form of diabetes need insulin therapy more often than people who have type 2 diabetes. So insulin is definitely a common therapy here. There may be some role for people who are obese, who are insulin resistant, who look a little bit like an overlap with type 2, to use some of the medications that are on the market for type 2 diabetes, particularly metformin, and then maybe some of the other newer ones like SGLT2 inhibitors or GLP-1 agonists. This is where things get really tricky with the GLP-1 agonists, right? Because they have been associated in post-marketing studies. So within trials of type 2 diabetes, there were higher lipase levels, not necessarily acute pancreatitis, just higher lipase levels. and post-marketing reports of acute pancreatitis that led to these warnings that the FDA has put on these products about acute pancreatitis risk. It does turn out that, at least for sort of the routine patient who has never had acute pancreatitis or a single episode of acute pancreatitis, a lot of the meta-analysis data, the epidemiologic data that's being looked at now suggests that, these might not really be a risk for acute pancreatitis. And in fact, they might cause weight loss, which then, reduces risk for subsequent acute pancreatitis. Although rapid weight loss can be associated with gallstones, and so there can be other GI complications certainly associated with these drugs. So I think we're entering an era where it's not clear that, like, this is a definite no, don't treat these patients with GLP-1 analogs, which is what I would might have said 3 or 4 years ago. I do think I saw there was a question in the chat about recurrent acute pancreatitis. Some of these patients will progress to recurrent acute pancreatitis and even to chronic pancreatitis. I do have a little bit more concern about those patients and getting sort of more robust data with GLP-1 analogs to really determine if it's a risk factor or not for exacerbating pancreatitis in those people who might have genetic disease and kind of prolonged disease. But maybe for your routine patient who just had one episode, especially if it was gallstone related and you've removed the inciting cause, maybe that's actually okay. I think the data are still coming out in that field, however.
Yeah,
I
that's a
would advise having
great
a
question.
really careful conversation about with your patient,
Got it.
though, if
It's
you were to do that, because I think you really need to discuss what is known and what is not known before
Got it.
putting
So
them on
for
this.
patients who may be on the call today, it's important to have a discussion with your physician about the risks and benefits, because the field is changing in this area fairly quickly. Now, just following up on treatment for diabetes, could you also comment about diet? Because diet and nutrition is very important, both from ex for exocrine insufficiency, but importantly for diabetes too.
Yeah, this is such a tricky area. And so I think that the diabetes diet really kind of depends on the individual person, right? So people who are overweight, have some of the insulin resistance and type 2 factors, probably benefit from low glycemic index, more carb-restricted diets. That may not be the case for perhaps people who have more malabsorption, need more calories. To gain weight. So I actually think there's a really important role for working carefully with a dietitian when you have these, two things going on, exocrine pancreas insufficiency and diabetes, to find the right balance for the individual patient as opposed to sort of a blanket protocol. Because it wouldn't be appropriate to restrict, a calorie intake in all people, especially if there's malabsorption. But also some individuals do need that type 2 diabetes diet.
Correct. And I also want to emphasize here that there is a typical misconception out there that if you have chronic pancreatitis or if you have pancreatitis, you should not eat fat, which I think is a misconception because you do need fat for normal body functions. But if you are taking pancreatic enzymes in the right doses, your body should be able to break those fats down and would be helpful. There was a question in the chat about pork allergy, which is an important point. And because of limited time, we could not cover. I would recommend you to see an allergist to get feedback in terms of whether there is a possibility of desensitization that could potentially be done. We also could not cover in the interest of time that if the pancreas is not making enough enzymes, other parts of the body, for example, stomach can increase lipase production, and many patients could actually maybe just cut down fat from their diet and may have less symptoms. So that's something to consider. So just to wrap things up, just key takeaways from the seminar is that patients with acute pancreatitis are at risk for both diabetes and exocrine insufficiency. And they need to be aware of that. Physicians need to be aware of that. And there are guidelines now coming out as to be that monitoring should be done over time. Early recognition is important because that can lead to proper evaluation and management. And then in patients with mild acute pancreatitis, just because their clinical symptoms improve does not mean that they are not at risk for other complications of pancreatitis in the future. So that needs to they need to be monitored. And Dr. Bellin, I'll give it to you for a final closing comment.
Excellent. Well, I really thank everyone for joining us, and I apologize. This session is so short that there may be more burning questions out there. I think if you send those to the NPF, they can certainly send them to Dr. Yadav or myself as well. And we really thank you for participating for and particularly for taking care for those of you who are providers, taking care of these patients, making sure that even after that episode of acute pancreatitis has resolved, that we're getting the appropriate monitoring for long-term health.
Thank you, everyone, and thank you to NPF for organizing this session.
All right. Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.